Chapter 4. Buttons and Pall Mall. Those who frequent the dismal and enormous mansions of silence which society has raised to ennui in that omphalos of town, Pall Mall, and which, because they knock you down with their dullness, are called clubs no doubt, those who yawn from a bay window in St. James Street, at a half score of other dandies gaping from another bay window over the way, those who consult a dreary evening paper for news, or satisfy themselves with the jokes of the miserable Punch by way of wit, the men about town of the present day, in a word, can have but little idea of London some 60 or 80 years back. Thou pudding-sided old dandy of St. James Street, with thy lacquered boots, thy dyed whiskers, and thy suffocating waistband, what art thou to thy brilliant predecessor in the same quarter? The brougham from which thou descendest at the portal of the Arlton or the Ravellers, is like everybody else's. Thy black coat has no more plates, nor buttons, nor fancy in it than thy neighbor's. Thy hat was made on the very block on which Lord Adlepates was cast, who has just entered the club before thee. You and he yawn together out of the same omnibus box every night. You fancy yourselves men of pleasure. You fancy yourselves men of fashion. You fancy yourselves men of taste. In fancy, in taste, in opinion, in philosophy, the newspaper legislates for you. It is there you get your jokes and your thoughts, and your facts and your wisdom, poor Pall Mall dullards. Stupid slaves of the press, on that ground which you at present occupy, there were men of wit and pleasure and fashion, some 25 lustres ago. We are at Buttons, the well-known sign of the Irk's Head. The crowd of periwigged heads at the windows, the swearing chairman round the steps, the blazoned and coronalled panels of whose vehicles denote the lofty rank of their owners, the throng of embroidered beaux entering or departing, and rendering the air fragrant with the odors of Polvilio and Pomander, proclaim the celebrated resort of London's wit and fashion. It is the corner of Regent Street. Carlton House has not yet been taken down. A stately gentleman in crimson velvet and gold is sipping chocolate at one of the tables, in earnest converse with a friend whose suit is likewise embroidered, but stained by time, or wine mayhap, or wear. A little deformed gentleman in iron gray is reading the Morning Chronicle newspaper by the fire, while a divine, with a broad brogue and a shovel hat and cassock, is talking freely with a gentleman, whose star and ribbon, as well as the unmistakable beauty of his Fidian countenance, proclaims him to be a member of Britain's aristocracy. Two ragged youths, the one tall, gaunt, clumsy and scrofulous, the other with a wild, careless, beautiful look, evidently indicating race, are gazing in at the window, not merely at the crowd in the celebrated club, but at Timothy the waiter, who is removing a plate of that exquisite dish, the muffin then newly invented, at the desire of some of the revelers within. I would, Sam, said the wild youth to his companion, that I had some of my mother Macclesfield's gold, to enable us to eat of those cates, and mingle with yon Springalds and Beau. Devant a knowledge of the stoical philosophy, said the youth addressed as Sam, might elicit a smile of incredulity upon the cheek of the parasite of pleasure, but there are moments in life when history fortifies endurance, and past study renders present deprivation more bearable. If our pecuniary resources be exiguous, let our resolution, Dick, supply the deficiencies of fortune. The muffin we desire today would little benefit us tomorrow. Poor and hungry as we are we less happy, Dick, than yon listless voluptuary who banquets on the food which you covet? And the two lads turned away up Waterloo Place, and passed the Parthenon clubhouse, and disappeared to take a meal of cow heel at a neighboring cook's shop. Their names were Samuel Johnson and Richard Savage. Meanwhile the conversation at Buttons was fast and brilliant. Why would 13s, and the divil go with 'em, cried the church dignitary in the cassock, is it in blue and gold ye are this morning, Sir Richard, when you ought to be in Siebel's? Who's dead, Dean? Said the nobleman, the dean's companion. Fakes, me Lard Bolingbroke, as sure as me name's Jonathan Swift, and I'm not so sure of that neither, for who knows his father's name? There's been a mighty cruel murder committed entirely. A child of Dick Steele's has been barbarously slain, thrown, and quartered, and it's Joe Addison yonther has done it. He should have killed one of your own, Joe, ye thief of the world. Aye, said the amazed, and right honorable Joseph Addison, I killed its child. I was godfather to the last, and promised a cup, and never sent it, Dick ejaculated. Joseph looked grave. The child I mean is Sir Roger de Coverley, knight and baronet. What made ye kill him, ye savage Mohawk? The whole town is in tears about the good knight. All the ladies at church this afternoon were in mourning. All the booksellers are wild, and Lintot says not a third of the copies of the Spectator are sold since the death of the brave old gentleman. And the Dean of St. Patrick's pulled out the Spectator newspaper, containing the well-known passage regarding Sir Roger's death. Bought it but now in Wellington Street, he said semicolon the newsboys were howling all down the Strand. What a miracle is genius, genius, the divine and beautiful, said a gentleman leaning against the same fireplace with the deformed cavalier in iron gray, and addressing that individual, who was in fact Mr. Alexander Pope, had a marvelous gift as this, and royal privilege of art, to make the ideal more credible than the actual, to enchain our hearts, to command our hopes, our regrets, our tears, for a mere brain-born emanation, to invest with life the incorporeal, and to glamour the cloudy into substance, these are the lofty privileges of the poet, if I have read PC aright, and I am as familiar with the sounds that rang from Homer's lyre, as with the strains which celebrate the loss of Belinda's lovely locks. Mr. Pope blushed and bowed, highly delighted. These, I say, sir, are the privileges of the poet. The poet's the maker. He moves the world, and asks no lever. If he cannot charm death into life, as Orpheus feigned to do, he can create beauty out of naught, and defy death by rendering thought eternal. Ho! Jemmy, another flask of Nance. And the boy, for he who addressed the most brilliant company of wits in Europe, was little more emptied the contents of the brandy flask into a silver flagon, and quaffed it gaily to the health of the company assembled. 'Twas the third he had taken during the sitting. Presently, and with a graceful salute to the society, he quitted the coffee house, and was seen cantering on a magnificent Arab past the National Gallery. Who is yon spark in blue and silver? He beats Joe Addison himself, in drinking, and pious Joe is the greatest toper in the three kingdoms, Dick Steele said, good-naturedly. His paper in the Spectator beats thy best, Dick, thou sluggard, the Right Honorable Mr. Addison exclaimed. He is the author of that famous number 996 for which you have all been giving me the credit. The rascal foiled me at capping verses, Dean Swift said, and won a tenpenny piece of me, plague take him. He has suggested an emendation in my Homer, apostrophe which proves him a delicate scholar, Mr. Pope exclaimed. He knows more of the French king than any man I have met with, and we must have an eye upon him, said Lord Bolingbroke, then Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, and beckoning a suspicious-looking person who was drinking at a side table, whispered to him something. Meantime, who was he? Where was he, this youth who had struck all the wits of London with admiration? His galloping charger had returned to the city. His splendid court suit was doffed for the citizen's gabardine and grocer's humble apron. George de Barnwell was in cheap, at the feet of Martha Millwood. Vol. 3. The Condemned Cell. Quid me mollibus implicas lacertis, my Eleanor? Nay, George added, a faint smile illumining his wan but noble features, why speak to thee in the accents of the Roman poet, which thou comprehendest not? Bright one, there be other things in life, in nature, in this inscrutable labyrinth, this heart on which thou leanest, which are equally unintelligible to thee. Yes, my pretty one, what is the unintelligible but the ideal? What is the ideal but the beautiful? What the beautiful but the eternal. And the spirit of man, that would commune with these is like him who wanders by the Athena Polyphloes Boethalysis, and shrinks awestruck before that azure mystery. Emily's eyes filled with fresh gushing dew. Peek on, speak ever thus, my George, she exclaimed. Barnwell's chains rattled as the confiding girl clung to him. Even Snoggin, the turnkey appointed to sit with the prisoner, was affected by his noble and appropriate language, and also burst into tears. You weep, my Snoggin, the boy said. And why? Hath life been so charming to me, that I should wish to retain it? Hath pleasure no after weariness? Ambition no deception, wealth no care, and glory no mockery? Sah! I am sick of success, palled of pleasure, weary of wine and wit, and nay, start not, my Adelaide and woman. I fling away all these things as the toys of boyhood. Life is the soul's nursery. I am a man, and pine for the illimitable. Mark you me. Has the morrow any terrors for me, think ye? Did Socrates falter at his poison? Did Seneca blench in his bath? Did Brutus shirk the sword, when his great stake was lost? Did even weak Cleopatra shrink from the serpent's fatal nip? And why should I? My great hazard hath been played, and I pay my forfeit. Lie sheathed in my heart, thou flashing blade. Welcome to my bosom, thou faithful serpent. I hug thee, peace-bearing image of the eternal. Ha, the hemlock cup. Fill high, boy, for my soul is thirsty for the infinite. Get ready the bath, friends. Prepare me for the feast. Tomorrow bathe my limbs in odors, and put ointment in my hair. As for a bath, Snoggin interposed, they're not to be had in this ward of the prison, but I dost say Hemi will get you a little oil for your hair. The prisoned one laughed loud and merrily. Why, guardian understands me not, pretty one and thou? What sayest thou? From those dear lips methinks plura sunt oscula quam sententi I kiss away thy tears, dove. They will flow apace when I am gone, then they will dry, and presently these fair eyes will shine on another, as they have beamed on poor George Barnwell. Yet wilt thou not all forget him, sweet one? He was an honest fellow, and had a kindly heart for all the world said that he had, cried the gaoler and the girl in voices gurgling with emotion. And you read. You unconvicted convict, you murderer, though haply you have slain no one, you felon in posse, if not in esteal gently with one who has used the opportunity that has failed thee, and believe that the truthful and the beautiful bloom sometimes in the dock and the convict's tawny gabardine. In the matter for which he suffered, George could never be brought to acknowledge that he was at all in the wrong. He may be an error of judgment, he said to the venerable chaplain of the gaol, but it is no crime. Were it crime, I should feel remorse. Where there is no remorse, crime cannot exist. I am not sorry. Therefore, I am innocent. Is the proposition a fair one? The excellent doctor admitted that it was not to be contested. And wherefore, sir, should I have sorrow, the boy resumed, for ridding the world of a sordid worm, asterisk of a man whose very soul was dross, and who never had a feeling for the truthful and the beautiful. When I stood before my uncle in the moonlight, in the gardens of the ancestral halls of the de Barnwells, I felt that it was the nemesis come to overthrow him. Dog, apostrophe I said to the trembling slave, tell me where thy gold is. Thou hast no use for it. I can spend it in relieving the poverty on which thou tramplest, in aiding science, which thou knowest not, in uplifting art, to which thou art blind. Give gold, and thou art free. Apostrophe but he spake not, and I slew him. I would not have this doctrine vulgarly promulgated, said the admirable chaplain, for its general practice might chance to do harm. Thou, my son, the refined, the gentle, the loving and beloved, the poet and sage, urged by what I cannot but think a grievous error, hast appeared as avenger. Think what would be the world's condition, were men without any yearning after the ideal, to attempt to reorganize society, to redistribute property, to avenge wrong. A rabble of pygmies scaling heaven, said the noble, though misguided young prisoner. Rametheus was a giant, and he fell. Yes, indeed, my brave youth, the benevolent Dr. Fuzzwig exclaimed, clasping the prisoner's marble and manacled hand. And the tragedy of tomorrow will teach the world that homicide is not to be permitted even to the most amiable genius, and that the lover of the ideal and the beautiful, as thou art, my son, must respect the real likewise. Look, here is supper, cried Barnwell gaily. His is the real, doctor, let us respect it and fall to. He partook of the meal as joyously as if it had been one of his early festals. But the worthy chaplain could scarcely eat it for tears. *This is a gross plagiarism. The above sentiment is expressed much more eloquently in the ingenious romance of Eugene Aram. He burning desires I have known, the resplendent visions I have nursed, the sublime aspirings that have lifted me so often from sense and clay. These tell me that whether for good or ill, I am the thing of an immortality and the creature of a god. I have destroyed a man noxious to the world. With the wealth by which he afflicted society, I have been the means of blessing many. Kidlingsby. By D. Shrewsbury, Esq. The whole world is bound by one chain. In every city in the globe there is one quarter that certain travelers know and recognize from its likeness to its brother district in all other places where are congregated the habitations of men. In Tehran, or Pekin, or Stamboul, or New York, or Timbuktu, or London, there is a certain district where a certain man is not a stranger. Where the idols are fed with incense by the streams of Ching Wang Fu, where the minarets soar sparkling above the cypresses, their reflections. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.